Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is David Leitch, an editor with the Titan Publishing Group, Titan Comics, and he has one of the coolest jobs I've heard of in a long time. He gets to fiddle around with vintage comics, vintage comic titles, vintage comic art, all the cool stuff. And this year is especially fun for him, and I'm going to say me too. It's the 50th anniversary of The Prisoner in the U.S. So last year and this year, we have 50 years of The Prisoner, and Titan has a lot of Prisoner-related titles coming out. The newest one is the Prisoner Original Art Edition, which collects the long-lost Jack Kirby Gil Kane artwork and story from the Marvel Comics Prisoner comic that they tried to put out in the 1970s but never went anywhere. So, David, welcome to the show and tell us all about this treasure trove.
I will do, Simon. Very nice to meet you, by the way. Yes, as you've already said, I work for Titan Comics. I'm an editor there, and I, for my love of comics, I've always handled the vintage stuff, and that's led into doing new comic editions of the old vintage stuff. So I've done new comics based on things like Dan Dare, Fighting American, that was one of mine. I've done Captain Kronos, Hammer's The Mummy, and obviously The Prisoner. And part of the Prisoner, when we got the license from ITV, we decided that we were going to reprint the Dean Motta sequel, Shattered Visage, which is coming out next year. But we also were going to attempt to print the Gil Kane and Jack Kirby artwork, which had never been collected before. And we were going to do brand new Prisoner stuff set in the Prisoner universe. So the first part of those three projects was to find the original artwork. Now, as luck would have it, we got hold of the Gil Kane artwork very easily and very quickly because one man had all of it, and he'd bought it all in auction, and he kept it all. And that was very easy. So when I got given the projects, within a matter of, I think it was 10 days to a week, we had access to all of the Gil Kane pages, which was, you know, pretty impressive. So we did a deal with the owner of that, and he sent us high-res scans of all the pages. And you're talking about really big scans. I mean, I think each one was about 100 meg in size. And when we opened those pages up, even though it was in the computer, because they were scanned from the original artwork, and it wasn't like a printed process, so you could see the color of the paper, you could see the notes, you could see the pencil marks, you could see everything. It was as close as I'll ever get to actually holding the artwork in my hands. And it was incredible. All the hairs stood up on my arm. In fact, they're standing up now because I was just so thrilled. So that unfortunately had the adverse effect of making me think finding the Jack Kirby artwork would be easy. And that actually took me 18 months of searching to actually find the Jack Kirby artwork. So what we did was I put feelers out. I tried to find out who might have it, and I saw that some pages had come from an auction, so I got in contact with the auction house, and they wouldn't tell me who had bought them in auction, and they didn't have high-risk scans, because if they had high-risk scans, that would have been it. So I had to go and try and find the buyer, and that took me, like I say, 18 months, and I went through three different sets of people to get to the actual owner. And the first guy that we talked to, I wouldn't say led me to believe, but I certainly got a sense that he had the artwork. But it turned out ultimately he didn't. He just knew someone who did. And so that led me to another guy who didn't have the artwork either. And then I got hold of the Kirby Museum and Rand Hope, who actually knew the man who had the artwork, which was fantastic. But he turned out to be a Hollywood actor. And he was very busy. So we had to wait until the time came up in his schedule so he could actually get us the artwork. And so that took about 6 months of back and forthing until finally he could get copies. And then once he got the copies, he had to do a different deal. And then finally, 18 months in total, I received a hard drive with all the pages on. And it was just, I said the hair stood up on my arms when it was the Gil Kane. But to see Jack Kirby pages like this was just, oh my God, it was fantastic. It was, I'm not ashamed to admit this, I actually cried. I'm not talking like I wasn't sobbing, I wasn't wretched by tears, but my eyes filled with tears and they streamed down my face, and I was just in utter awe that I was looking at this artwork. Because I knew sort of, you know, I knew when you start doing these books, you start looking into it and you start reading about it and you start to find out the history and the whole thing behind it, you know. So I learned the story of what happened to the artwork and why the project, well, not why the project was abandoned, but I worked out, you know, Gil Kane did it first, so Steve Englehart wrote a script based on the pilot episode, then Gil Kane drew it, and then Jack Kirby came back to Marvel. He'd been at DC, he came back, and then he took over the prison and did his version of it, and it was based on the pilot episode Arrival. So they both did goes with it, and then for some inexplicable reason, Marvel decided not to go with it. So I knew all that, I knew the whole history, so it was wonderful to actually track this stuff down. But the other great thing was is that in that research, I met people like Steve Englehart, and he was fantastic, and he gave me stuff which was just stunned me. He still had files which were his original Xeroxes of the script. Mm. So he scanned those and sent them to me. So I got these Xeroxes of his original script, which was just like, this is fantastic. So we decided that we were going to, as well as do the Gil Kane, we were going to actually letter the Gil Kane artwork, because they had balloon placements done on the artwork, so squares were indicated where the lettering should go, but it had never been lettered. So what I did was I decided that I didn't want to do modern lettering. I wanted to do old school lettering. I wanted to get a proper letterer. And so I got in contact with Rick Parker. Now, Rick Parker's a brilliant American cartoonist, and he used to draw, the thing I remembered him most for, because I used to edit it when I worked at Marvel UK, he used to draw Beavis and Butthead, and that was a fantastic comic. So I was friends with him on Facebook. So when I needed an old school letterer, I got in contact and said, would you like to do it? And he jumped at the chance. And so he hand lettered all of it, and then I scanned it and took his lettering and combined it with the artwork. And then I took Steve Englehart's script and I transcribed it, because we couldn't reprint the actual facsimile, not the facsimiles, we couldn't reprint the Xeroxes because they were so degraded, you wouldn't be able to make it out. So I transcribed the whole script, got Steve to approve it, so he said, yeah, this is what I wrote, you know. So it was a perfect transcription of the script. And so that's what we used to letter the Rick Parker version of the Gil Kane. So we put that in the book as well as Gil Kane's artwork. We had the Jack Kirby stuff, which had been, five pages of which had been inked by Mike Royer. And also the whole of the Jack Kirby had been lettered as well by Mike. And so I got in contact with Mike Royer, and he gave me a foreword to the book, which was wonderful, and he sent me two signed photos of Patrick McGoohan. Oh. And I found out that when he'd met, because Mike had been working for Disney at the time, and he'd met Patrick McGoohan on the studios, Disney Studios, and I worked out what film they must have met on, which was the old, do you remember the old Disney dinosaur movie called Baby?
Yes.
Right, so Patrick McGoohan was in that. And so he was at the Disney Studios at that time. That's when he was making that film, and that's when Mike Royer met him. And so Mike drew a picture for Patrick McGoohan, which was Mickey Mouse being chased by a rover. But Mickey Mouse is dressed like the prisoner. And he signed that, and he gave me a copy of that, which he put into the book as well, which was just, honestly, I loved putting this book together. Of all the books, and I've done dozens and dozens of books of Titan. I mean, I've been at Titan for 10 years, and I've done loads and loads of books. But this Prisoner book for me is the pinnacle. I've never produced a book like this before, and I'm so honoured to have had a chance to put it together, because it was like a dream come true for me, absolute dream come true. So anyway, I'm rambling already. So Mike Roy did that for me. Steve Englehart gave me his script. He also wrote me an article about his involvement with the prisoner and how he came to write the script, which was wonderful. And then he gave me something else, which was another Xerox given to him at the time he wrote the script. And what this was the ITC, because in those days, the ITV exists now, which is the independent television company, but mm-hmm. they used to be called ITC. And ITC were the ones who did The Prisoner. So they issued a press pack at the time of the TV show in 1967, which was sent out, which is, I think, a 16-page just pure text all about The Prisoner, which they'd send out to people who they wanted to write features about. And so he sent me this facsimile, and I thought, this is fantastic. I really want to put this in the book as one of the extras, but it's not good enough. Now, as luck would have it, by now, news had sort of spread about the fact that we were doing this. And so I started being contacted by Prisoner fans. Now, one of them was a terrific guy who runs the Unmutual Society, which is one of the Prisoner fan clubs, called Rick Davey. Now, Rick was a huge Prisoner fan, and he had an original ITC press book, which was in his collection, and he loaned it to me so I could actually scan it. And so I was able to scan that and put it in the back of the book as well. And then Rick wrote me a feature all about the making of the TV show, just to sort of put it in context. Then it turned out, because it's just crazy, Then it turned out that Mike Allred was a gigantic, I mean, just, it was really funny. He was a huge Prisoner fan, so much so that when I got in contact with him, he said, you're not going to believe this. He said, I'm sitting currently in my Prisoner blazer whilst I'm sat in my large ball chair, because he has a giant ball chair like in the Prisoner. And I said, well, look, would you be interested in colouring the Jack Kirby spread from the Prisoner? And he went, oh, wow, that would be fantastic. And he was so excited. And so him and Laura, they coloured me the opening spread from the Jack Kirby strip, which we used as one of our variant covers on the actual comic. And then I did it as because the wonderful thing about the original art book is its actual size. It's the size that it was drawn at, which one of the things that makes this book so incredible is it's one of those fantastic, great big art books, you know, it's fantastic. So you're going through the book and you suddenly turn the page and you're just presented with this gigantic double page spread in glorious color, colored by Mike Allred. So it's just heaven. It was heaven. So that was how I put together the... and obviously, I keep saying I, but there were loads of people involved. You know, I had a fantastic designer. I had, you know, I mean, the people at ITV were very helpful and supportive. People like Rand Hope was brilliant. You know, all these people have been really sort of, you know, they all saw the sort of passion and the sort of, you know, the fact that we were making something really special, you know. And I really wanted to make a book that would sort of transcend being a book and become an artifact. It would become something that wouldn't just be sort of you'd find in a thrift shop somewhere. It would actually be a book that people would buy and they would hang on to it because they realized it was something special. And that's wonderful. It's very rare that we get a chance to do that sort of stuff. So that for me was terrific. So that's one of the Prisoner books. Then I did the Prisoner, the new Prisoner comic, which was written by Peter Milligan. So I wrote the original plot for that, and then Peter Milligan, he wrote the full script for it. And that's called The Uncertainty Machine, and issue 4 is just about to go on sale. So that's a four-book miniseries, and that's drawn by Colin Lorimer, who's a brilliant artist. And then that's coloured by Joanne Lafuente. And she's his like colorist of choice, and that's just a delight. That is, I'm really chuffed. It's one of the there are certain comics you get to work on when you're dealing with licensees, you're dealing with artists, which are an absolute joy to work on. But nothing goes wrong. It's just terrific. And the Prisoner is one of them because a Peter Milligan is an absolute gentleman and a terrific pleasure to work with. And you know, there's sitting there, we had a couple of meetings where at the beginning where we talked about it over beer, overlooking the Thames, because the nearest pub to us is just overlooking the Thames, which is very nice. And it was just great just to talk to him and, you know, and sort of find out what he wanted to do with it. It was just sensational. So the whole project has just been an absolute joy to do. And there's a real, there's this sense, if you collect books, and I do, a lot of the time, it's the hunting of the books, which is the fun part. When you actually finally get the book you're after, there's a certain sense of disappointment because that search is now over. So, for example, I'm a huge EC fan. I love EC comics, and I've got all of the Gemstone hardback slipcase editions. But that took me 25 years of searching for to get them all. And when I got my last one, it was one of those crazy stories that I actually did a deal. I handed over an envelope of money to a person I'd never met before at the Eurostar station at Waterloo, and they handed me this large, massive package, which was the last two volumes in the set. And it was just like a spy novel. But there was a real sense of like, oh, I've done it. I've collected all the books. It's taken me 25 years. What do I collect next? So I had the same sort of thing with The Prisoner, which is that you put out 4 issues, and there's a load of stuff that goes on. You know, you go through the script, you do all that, you go through pencils, then you go through the inks, then you go through the colouring, then you're lettering it, then you're sending it off for proof. There's loads of different stages, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But there was a real sense that when I put that final issue into studio and then off to production to get printed, there was a real sense of, oh, it's over, and, you know? And that's sad because, you know, I love these things. It's crazy. I've been a professional cartoonist, and I've been involved in comics for 32 years now. I've been doing it ever since I left college. I love comics. I absolutely adore them. But it's the making of them which I adore. It's the physical manufacturing of them which I find, oh, it's like a drug. Honestly, the hairs on my arms are standing up again. I've got goosebumps because I'm thinking about comics, which I know sounds incredibly, you know, oh my God, this man's a weirdo. But I love them. I absolutely love them. I love them to bits. I'm rambling.
That's okay. There are a lot of people who love comics. There are a lot of people who love certain comic stories. There are some people who are more loyal to imprints than they are to characters or storylines. And it's a shared love of comics that a lot of us have. So I know the feeling. I really do know the feeling.
It's wonderful, isn't it? It's like. Yeah, I understand it more than I can. I mean, I tried to watch some of the World Cup. I have no interest in football, and I tried to watch the World Cup with friends who are like big, passionate football fans, but I couldn't get it. I didn't understand why they were getting so angry and sort of frustrated by it, because I think the thing I found about comics is that when there's comics that you love, they don't make you angry and frustrated. They sort of, they're exhilarating. They're sort of a good comic, you know. I mean, a good comic will stay with you. You'll think about it. You'll go back and you'll read it again, and you can read it 5, 10, 15, 20 times, and it still will be exhilarating and enjoyable. And I think there's a quality about comics which doesn't exist in other things, that you go back to them and you look at them and they provide the same joy as they did the first time. That's what I think, anyway.
I will admit to being a soccer fan. I follow the World Cup. I understand certain passions, because I'm also a baseball fan. And you hope... You put your hopes into these teams, and when they do well, you feel like, yes, I can do better too. And when they lose, you go, oh, man.
See, that's what I don't get, because I watched a match. I actually watched 5 matches in the World Cup this year. I watched all the England ones, and I also watched the one between Japan and Belgium, which I had nothing invested in either team. So I just watched it from watching two teams play football. And that's the one I enjoyed the most, because I didn't care who won. I could actually just enjoy watching the football. Mm-hmm. And the thing was that when I watched football with England in a room full of football fans who were all rooting for England, I didn't enjoy it as much, because their frustration and annoyance sort of it ruined it. Because I wanted to go, oh, they played very well, didn't they? We lost, you fool, we lost. Yeah, I know, but we did quite well. I mean, you know, that bloke at the back there, he did very well. And it was, apparently I didn't get it, and I was ridiculed for my ignorance, you know. But there we are.
I completely understand. I get it. And your enjoyment of the Belgium game is understandable. I started rooting for them this cup because there was a set of Volkswagen ads in America that were on American television that started out really snarky. They said, sorry, your team isn't in the World Cup this year, America. Maybe you should try rooting for Belgium. After all, we host the world's largest electronic dance music festival, and the two guys in the car start, you know, bopping to electronic dance music, and it's the funniest thing I've seen.
See, I like that. I like that. I can see why you then root for Belgium. And obviously, don't forget, they are the home of Tintin. So that's another reason to root for Belgium.
Actually,
I did.
You're
a comic fan.
I'm a fan of Belgian beer, actually. Belgian ale.
Oh,
so.
I'm teetotal, but I am a fan of Belgian comics. So
There you go. So The Prisoner of the Uncertainty Machine is the 4-issue miniseries that came out this year. Tell our listeners where in the Prisoner timeline that story fits.
Oh, well, what that fits in is that when we looked at the prisoner and it was like, what we can do with this, it fits right now in the present. It's slam bang now. It's not set in the 60s. It's not, you know, because I find it puzzling to take old licenses and to do new stuff that set them in the past, because when The Prisoner first came out, it was contemporary. So it's not as if he set it in the 1940s. McGuinn set it in the 1960s because it was contemporary. So I have a problem of doing stuff now but setting it in the 60s, because it's like, but that's 50 years ago. Why would you do that? It's no longer contemporary. So I wanted to do something new with it. But the other thing was, is as far as I'm concerned, number 6 escapes from the village. He's free. He's got away. So if you went back to it and you actually stuck number 6 back into the village, in a way, as far as I'm concerned, you're sort of betraying his memory and what he's done and what he's achieved. So it was a whole sense of, what if the village is still around? What if it still exists? What if it's in the present? And how would it operate in our world today? So that was the starting point, which is, now we're doing a new story set in the village. So the village is still wherever it is. I mean, I know that it was filmed in Port Marion, and that hasn't changed. So the village in our story is still the Port Marion village, but it's like, but where is the village, or what is the village, more to the point? And more to the point, who is number two and who is number one. You know, that's the things that I thought were what was interesting about it. So we did a contemporary one, set it slam bang in the present, but we also wanted to retain sort of the weirdness of the show. It wasn't about trying to. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the way that things have become very gritty and mean and moody in our entertainment. Not just in comics, but across the board, everything's become very sort of. I would actually say like po-faced and almost too serious. And if you look at the original Prisoner, yes, it was serious because obviously in McGoohan's show, it wasn't a comedy, but there were still elements of surrealism in it. There were still elements of humour in it. There was still a sort of, it wasn't cut and dried. There were other things going on. And I sort of wanted the comic to do that as well, to actually share some of those sensibilities. So not to be an out and out spy thing, but to sort of share the weirdness, the sort of the surrealism of the show. So we set it in the present and try to capture the essence of the show.
Now, will there be more of that going forward, coming soon, or other stories?
We'd very much like it to. I mean, what we've done was the four miniseries. We wanted to see how well it does and how well the graphic novel sells. Peter's written the treatment for the second arc, but I'm not at liberty to divulge what happens in that. But it's certainly something that we would like to sort of, you know, push it on and see what happens next, because Peter's got some fantastic ideas about how we take our number six and what we do with him. So it could be a very interesting time to be the prisoner. Let's leave it there. Dot, 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 he said.
Well, in addition to the original Jack Kirby, Gil Kane story that was initially set to be published by Marvel in the 70s.
Right,
there was something else called Shattered Visage that was supposed to be in the late 80s, early 90s. Was it which?
Well, it was actually the 20 years after the TV show. So it came out in 87 or 88. Yeah, 88, 87, 88, yeah. So what that was, that's very interesting, because that was Dean Motta. And that's actually the official sequel to the TV show. So it was completely endorsed by Patrick McGoohan, and he had complete write off on every page of artwork that was produced. He had final say.
And that was considered an authorized original sequel to the original story.
Absolutely. It's the only official authorized sequel to the original TV show, and that was authorized by McGoohan and also ITV. So it was completely, it's pure canon as well. It's the sequel. Absolutely, it's a sequel. I mean, it's sort of, and then he was able to do things that we couldn't. I mean, his main character is actually her surname's Drake, so she's clearly sort of referencing to the Danger Man Drake, which we weren't allowed to do. We couldn't call our agent Drake because, or even a Danger Man, because those two licenses are completely separate. Mm-hmm. So even though, you know, obviously McGoohan was the Danger Man originally in the 60s. And he always claimed that The Prisoner wasn't a sequel, but I know that there is that sort of sense that, well, you could look at it as being that The Prisoner is actually Drake. Although McGoohan did say that The Prisoner, as far as he was concerned, was a scientist. And if you watch the show, there's no reason why he has to be a secret agent. He could just be a very, very physically adept scientist. Because back then, especially in movies and TV shows, scientists were two types. They're either extremely able young men, able to fight and do the rest, and also be nerdy scientists. Or they were like exceedingly elderly gentlemen who were pillars of all wisdom. Those are the two main schools of scientists, I think.
And those elderly scientists were fit, able fighters when they were younger, so...
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's the main thing is, if you go to uni to be a scientist, there is the fighting a syllabus, isn't there? You have to do at least a term's worth of sword fighting and fisticuffs.
There you go. See, that's what we're missing. We need to put fencing and sword fighting into high school curriculum here.
Just to
have people burn off energy. So,
yeah, more sword fighting, please. That'd be excellent. I like that.
That'd be awesome.
That would be awesome.
What is Shattered Visage? Is actually a reprint. That was originally published in its entirety, and you're doing now is actually the reprint of that collection, right?
Yes. What we're doing is, originally it was done by DC. I think it was DC? Yeah, it was DC. Or was it No, it was DC. Yes, it was definitely DC. So we're reprinting again. Dean Motta's doing us a feature about the comic, and also he's giving us access to his art archive. So we'll be able to put in things like his hopefully do things like his development artwork, so character sketches, and maybe even unseen pages and all sorts of stuff like that. So it should be a very interesting book. And we've got he's done us he's revised the cover, his original cover, and we've got access to the sort of the actual film from the original comics, or we'll be reusing that. So it's gonna be very interesting. What's nice will be that we'll have done the whole Prisoner thing. We'll have sort of done all the bits of it, you know, and it'll all be under the Titan banner. So I think that's very nice. And I got to say that you know, it's sort of, for me, it's a real honor just to be a small, a tiny little cog in the Prisoner universe now, you know, that I've actually helped to sort of do this stuff. So that's a nice sense, nice feeling, you know, that I've done a little bit to help it along.
Well,
I like feeling that.
Well, it's a great service to the Prisoner fans, because the stuff you've collected in the original art edition are stuff that very, very few people on the planet have ever seen. And
yes,
now you're
true.
Putting it out in a book format where people can see the development of this comic that actually never saw the light of day. And even like you said, the image of Mike Royer's Mickey Mouse that he drew for Patrick McGoohan as the Prisoner is just so adorable.
I know. That's what I love about it. It's like, it's these little things. This is why I love putting together vintage books, because I've done the same sorts of things for Dan Dare. I collect old vintage Dan Dare, but I've also done Flash Gordon. I've also done Mandrake the Magician. Now, Mandrake the Magician is the very first costumed crime fighter. You know, I mean, he predates Superman and Batman by a good 10 years. You know, and he was a newspaper strip, and obviously it was written by Lee Falk and originally drawn by Phil Davis. Now, I love old newspaper strips, just love them. That's how I got interested in comics in the first place, was newspaper strips. The comic bit came much later. But when I went looking for the Phil Davis stuff, what's wonderful is that the fan bases for all these comics, they're just full of nice people. I was trying to think of another way to describe them, but they are just genuinely nice people. I've joined a few sort of like web groups, and these guys are lovely. You know, you talk to them, they'll share their artwork with you. You know, you're talking about collectors who've got like, you know, years worth of material, and they'll happily share it for you. And all they want in return is a little mention in the book and maybe a couple of copies of the book, you know, and that's it. And it's just heaven. It's because they have this shared passion, but you also find things along the way. So for example, when I did Mandrake the Magician, I did a bit of research and discovered that when Mandrake the Magician was a comic strip, there's also a magician called Mandrake the Magician, who was a magician. And the crazy thing was that they both happened by accident without knowing of the other's existence, and they both became very popular. And certainly Lon Mandrake, who is the actual real-life magician, he's actually a very famous magician if you go and research and find out about him. So I got in contact with his son. So his son was fantastic. He's called Lon Mandrake Jr., brilliant guy, or Leon. And now I probably got his name. My brain's frazzled. Anyway, I wish I could get people's names correct the first time, but there we are. Anyway, he wrote me a wonderful biography of his father, but he also gave me he gave me copies of some like original photos from his family's like archive. And he sent me things like one of his dad's playbills. So information all about him, you know, how to get in contact, how to book him. And it's just wonderful, you know, but they don't want anything. They just want to share. They just want to carry this on. That's what I love about this stuff is that, A, you're putting the comics in, which is what people buy it for, but I also try and give the reader something different, something they're not going to know, something that's going to sort of be interesting to read, you know. I did a whole collection of Betty Boop, which was a hard one. We tried to do a complete collection of Betty Boop, so do all of the Sundays and all of the daily strips that were ever done, and we got nearly, I think ultimately we got every single Sunday, and these, you're talking the proper big sheets, the big broadsheets Sunday, so none of your three panel, we're talking about a full page,
right?
And then we went after the daily strips. So I ended up getting in contact with an Italian collector of Betty Boop who spoke no English and I spoke no Italian. We had to communicate using Google, and I was able to get hold of his collection. And he had original tear sheets from the newspapers going back to the 1920s, which he loaned to me. And isn't that incredible?
Wow.
That, So I was able to sort of put together this collection, and then it was like doing other stuff. It was like finding fans who would send me stuff, and I'd put them in, and we'd do features about it. Honestly, this stuff is what makes my job so exhilarating. It's playing in this world. I feel sometimes like a comic archaeologist, you know, that you go exploring, you go digging, and you find stuff, and it's wonderful. I'm like, I was about to say, I'm just like Indiana Jones, but slightly more handsome. Honestly, I love this. I love it. I just doing the vintage books is so exhilarating for me, because these are all books I read as a kid. They're all things that I knew about, and I think if you're a comic fan, you invariably know the history of comics. You know where they came from. You know why American comic format is the size they are. It's because they used to reprint the newspaper strips. So you have the whole history. You know where it's come from. And that's what makes it so interesting, is there's this wonderful history the comics has. It's incredible. It's the first new art form of the 20th century, you know. It's exhilarating. It's wonderful. So to play in it, to find it, to explore it, to find this artwork, to hold it again, and to bring it to new audiences. So to collect it into new books and to present material that's been lost and not seen, you know, for decades and decades. That's fantastic. There's a buzz out of it. It's brilliant. Sorry.
That's
I'm
okay.
Getting too excited.
No,
I'm going to take
just
a deep breath.
Breathe. Now, are there any other vintage titles, characters who you would be interested in, you know, conducting a new archaeology trip on? Because, like, I'm a huge fan of the original Shadow Radio serials.
And, oh, wow. Okay.
And back in the day, what was it? The Spirit. When they came out with a collection of the Spirit comics, that I think the first one, I was just so excited about it. And then they came out with that movie, and we won't talk about that movie at all.
No, never. that movie was horrible. I've got a funny story about that movie. So for a while, for 4 years out of my career in comics, I went back to college and I retrained as an animator. And when I left college, I went looking for work, and I heard that there was a new film starting up called Spirit. And I thought, oh, wow, a comic based on the Spirit, fantastic. So I got in contact and I went to see them. I took my show reel, and I was very excited. And they were just crewing up at the time. And so I went in, and I was really enthusiastic, and I explained how much I liked Will Eisner's Spirit and how brilliant it was and how groundbreaking, and I was a real comic fan. I really, really wanted to work on it. And he said, actually, it's about a horse called...
Yes!
I didn't get the job. Which I only go, listeners, if this ever happens to you, make sure you do your research properly before you go and see people. That's the valuable lesson I learned there. Okay.
I know, because they've done what, two or three different Spirit the Stallion movies now, the little animated.
Have they?
Yeah, I think so. I saw a new one on Netflix last year, I think.
Well, I tell you something. If you're training as an animator, the single hardest thing to do is to do a horse. That's the hardest thing to animate, because a bloody horse four-legged walk cycle is an absolute nightmare. So if anything, I was probably saved from fate worse than death. So there we are. That's my Spirit story. I did once meet Will Eisner.
Oh.
That's a funny story. I was many moons ago, we used to have one comic convention in England every year, and it was called UCAC, which is the UK Comic Art Convention. And they used to do this thing where all the guests would line up and they'd go on stage and they'd be introduced by the host of the show. And so I was stood in the line waiting to go up. And I'd only been a professional cartoonist for, I think it was 2 or 3 years. And I was doing stupid kids cartoons, because that's what I love drawing. I love drawing comic strips for kids. And that's how I started off. And so I'm in the queue. There's a guy in front of me, an elderly bloke, completely bald, an American, and he's chatting away. And suddenly I realized that I'm standing behind Will Eisner. Now, Will Eisner is a big influence. I just love his artwork, just astonishing. And I become like this crazy little, you know, super fan. And it's like, oh, Mr. Eisner, oh, my God, it's fantastic. Would you please sign something for me? And he went, yeah, sure, buddy, of course, no problem at all. So he'd done an illustration for the booklet. But I was so excited that I didn't know. So I just turned to the first random page I could find in the booklet. I just can't remember, it wasn't even his artwork. And I said, would you sign this? And he looked at it and he goes, but I didn't draw that. And I said, yeah, I know, but it's the only bit of paper I got. And he said, well, wouldn't you rather I sign the one that I've actually drawn? It was like, oh, okay. So somewhere on these shelves in this room I'm walking around, I've actually got a signed Will Eisner comic, which was nice. That's sadly the only thing I got to say to him, but it was It was, looking back at it now, it was rather funny. So there we are. That's my Will Eisner story.
A true fan of comics and comic art you are. So what vintage, what other vintage title would you collect? I sent you on that tangent, so I'm sorry about that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, I've done Dan Dare, so that's 1950s. I've done Manjake, which is the 1920s at least, maybe even 30s. I've done things like Roy the Rovers, who's, if you like soccer, Roy the Rovers is an amazing British football character. I've done him. He's fantastic. He actually, he's one of those weird cartoon characters who actually had continuity. So his football career would last, you know, every year. It would carry on. It would keep rolling. That's fascinating. I did a wonderful collection of Jane. That she was a World War II character. In fact, no, she didn't go. She was a flapper, so she'd been going since the 1920s. And but she became popular during the Second World War, and she was a newspaper strip, and she would constantly lose her clothing, and that was mainly the story. So the incredibly attractive young girl would lose her clothing, and you'd get a glimpse of bare bottom or boob, that sort of stuff. But there's this amazing story, which is that Winston Churchill described her as Britain's greatest secret weapon, and on the day this is true, but. This is legend. I don't know if it's true, but this is certainly legend. I did actually look into this, but I couldn't get clarification. It's said that the day that she was, for the first time ever, completely naked in the comic strip, and you couldn't see anything because it was obviously very chaste, but she ended up completely naked. Apparently, the the British Fifth Army advanced 7 miles. Apparently, now, I don't know if it's true, but it's a wonderful story. But I do know this, that when submariners were sent off on their missions, they were given advanced copies of this newspaper strip, Jane, so they'd read it, so they could keep on reading her adventures. Because she was an incredible boon, propaganda. She was a massive propaganda boon. And because during the war, she became a WAF, so she was actually in uniform in the strip. So she was an amazing... But the thing I find incredible, that these cartoon characters... At the time, they resonate. They're incredibly powerful, but they get forgotten along the way. And I find that so sad. So you sort of say to me, you know, what vintage would I bring back? What I would truly love to do, because I don't think it's been done yet, is I would love to do new Doc Savage. I would love to try and find a way of capturing the essence of Doc Savage and doing new material with Doc Savage, but trying to sort of make it work. Now the thing is, there was never a Doc Savage newspaper strip, you know, so that's a shame, but. That's for me what I would love, and you know, you mentioned the Shadow and all that sort of stuff, and I love the pulps. I mean, that's where our comics come from. That's you know, I mean, if you look at the lineage of comics, you can trace them back to the pulps and all that sort of stuff. And I find that the pulps are extraordinary. It must have been an amazing amazing era to be involved in. You know, if I'd been an editor back then, it would have been incredible to sort of. The amount of words it was pumped out there month after month in hundreds of magazines. It's extraordinary that there could be so much, you know. I just find that it's such an exhilarating creative time and all this sort of stuff being pumped into the zeitgeist, all these incredible heroes, these incredible adventures. Just fantastic, you know. It was sort of... Oh. Sorry, I'm all excited again. Stop. This is silly. Stop torturing me.
I am a huge fan of your enthusiasm and your passion for this, and just finding out what other things you would want to work on, finding out what other artists and other stories just drive your interest makes me curious. I'm like, okay, well, you know, maybe he's interested in something I haven't checked out before. Maybe I should go check that out.
I'm trying to think. I mean, I'm literally walking around my room now trying to find if there's anything that I've... I mean, and you do find things. I mean, I'm fairly sure that all the things that sort of have molded me and shaped me as an artist and as an editor, I guarantee that like 9 out of 10 things you and I we're going to agree on, you know? I mean, I'm guessing, I mean, do you know much about like European comics? Are you a fan of the European school?
I remember... I knew about Tintin way, way back in the day, and there was another, who was it, the comic book that people got confused with the D.B. Cooper, Dan Cooper. There was a story, and how, like, you know, D.B. Cooper, the guy who hijacked the plane.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right. Yes.
His character, his name wasn't D.B. Cooper. He gave his name as Dan Cooper, and Dan Cooper was supposedly a character in a French comic back in the day, and that's all I know. I've never gone and looked for it because I'm not a D.B. Cooper addict. Like, I actually knew somebody who was a major D.B. Cooper addict. I'm like, you know that money? You're not going to find that money.
Well, didn't they find that? Don't the authorities think they actually found what was left of him?
I don't know that they ever found his body, but they found like $5,000 or $10,000 that was had landed in a river, but it wasn't anywhere close to how much money he supposedly got away with. Yeah. But just the fact that this guy was probably a paratrooper, that he picked the name for his heist from a French comic book that he probably read when he was in Vietnam, since that was Vietnam was a French colony before the war. That's just, I'm like, wow.
That is brilliant.
You know, D.B. Cooper was a comics fan too.
I love that sort of stuff. That's fascinating. That is good. But I can't. I mean, I'm. You know, I think most of the things I like going back to sort of. You know, could I find something that which you don't know about, which you might. You know, I mean, you mentioned Tintin. I'm a huge Tintin fan. He's one of my influences. I mean, Asterix the Gaul, I think, is wonderful. I'm a huge fan of a Belgian artist, Jacobs, who was one of Hergé's assistants, and he went on to do a comic called Blake and Mortimer. Blake and Mortimer is fantastic, just brilliant. There's one of those comics is called The Yellow M, and it's one of the best comics I've ever read in my life. I absolutely adore it. And he also did things like Secret of the Swordfish, which was a three-part epic, astonishing. You can get this sort of stuff. It's quite available. So I love that. I truly love though, and it's a great shame because I think the film has sort of ruined it. If you read the original Valerian comics, they are sensational. Absolutely sensational.
I was just going to ask you that because wasn't Valerian and I think Snowpiercer, those are European comics, as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Snowpiercer, which Titan have actually published the Snowpiercer. They've done, I think they're working on a third volume of Snowpiercer. So, I was trying to think of something that which maybe you weren't aware of that you could sort of have a look at. And I'm actually standing here looking at my shelves of comics thinking, what have I got that you might not have heard of? But you're going to probably know all of this sort of stuff, you know? I mean, you know all the 2000 AD stuff. I mean, that's a big thing for me, you know, like Strontium Dog and all that, Nemesis and that sort of stuff. What else have I got? what I've got here now, I'm standing in front. This is my favourite shelf. So I've got a Billy. You know what a Billy bookcase is from IKEA?
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a Billy, and it's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 shelves, and each one is full of British annuals. Now, British annuals are a perfect thing, which we used to do wonderfully, but I only collect up to 1980, and I stopped, because after that, they will become pretty lame. So these are all hardbound books. Some of them used to come with dust jackets, but on the whole, they don't. And every Christmas, this used to be, especially in the UK, if you got, and I used to get annuals as a kid. So when you at Christmas, you'd be given an annual, and you would sort of, you'd lie on the floor, and you'd be in your pajamas, and you'd just read it. You'd pore over every page, and it would be fantastic. So I've got annuals from any sort of famous British comic you can think of. I've got Battle. I've got Action annuals. I've got Beano annuals. I've got Beezer. I've got Buster. I've got the Dandy. I've got Tiger. I've got Topper. I've got I got Hurricane and Jet and Jag. Just these things are just wonderful, and they're lovely hard. They're hardbound. You know, not bound. They're hard case. They're sort of. They've got dust jackets in them. They've got end papers. They're just wonderful things. And the great thing is that they used to be girls' annuals. Now, girls' annuals were different because girls could be trusted to have a dust jacket on their annuals, so they wouldn't damage it. So we'd have a whole range of... Now, that's the weird thing. In this country, there's a wonderful history of comics for girls. Now, the crazy thing is that a lot of the times, comics for girls sold more than comics for boys. But the weird thing is that these comics don't exist anymore because girls, by their nature back then, weren't really collectors of comics. So there aren't that many old girls' comics left in circulation, whereas there are literally hundreds and hundreds. Like 2000 AD, you fall over yourself finding old copies of 2000 AD, even going back to you know, the first 5 years. There's because it's one of those comics that we all collected because for some unknown reason we all knew it was something special. So we all collected it. And for a while, I used to have three complete collections of 2018. For the first, 3 years, I had three perfect collections because I had my own, and then I had one I bought off a friend, and then I had another one I came across in a junk shop. You know, it's just the sort of things that you do. But these girls annuals. So I'm looking at here, an annual here called Bunty, the Book for Girls from 1967, and it has this wonderful dust jacket. Now the lovely thing about these gorgeous books, especially the girls annuals, not only do they have the dust jackets, they'd have these lovely like cutout sections. So you get to the middle, and there'd be like paper dolls that you'd cut out. And they'd be beautifully printed, and they were just elegant. They were nice things. And all the stories would always be about things like blind ballerinas or girls stuck in a boarding school with a terrible headmistress. And it'd all be these adventure stories, but from a... And I say girly, as in, I mean sort of like... not derogatively, but like they're all girly adventures. They were written for what the idea of back then what girls would like. So it'd all be things like ballet. It would all be things like gymnastics. There'd be all that sort of stuff. There'd always be girls in extreme jeopardy fighting against wicked stepmothers and that sort of stuff to be reunited with their fathers who'd been lost in the Amazon while looking for a butterfly. That sort of stuff. But they were fantastic, you know. So that's something you should go and look into.
I can't believe that they don't exist anymore. Somebody had to have kept them. They have to be somewhere.
They are, but just not in as many numbers as the boys' comics. Mm-hmm. That's the weird thing. They just don't turn up as often. So you do find them, but and I think in a weird way, when you do find them, it's much more fun because they're slightly rarer because they just don't exist in the same number. So they're quite good fun. So the other thing that the UK was good at. Is and we get loads of these. You'll find these like not comic strips, but what we call we got this tradition over here, and I think you do in the States as well. Pocket cartoons, so little cartoon panels that you get in newspapers. But a lot of British cartoonists would bring out books, so they do their own little books and they would illustrate those. And we have this glorious tradition of those sort of things. So I'm looking at my shelf here. You've got people like Ronald Searle doing book after book. Now Ronald Searle, he created the Miss Trinians. Characters, you know, the girls from St. Trinians, not Miss St. Trinians, and he's a brilliant cartoonist, and you know, so those sort of things, they're wonderful to find. Oh my goodness, then we've got these fantastic comics, right? These are wonderful. So obviously the British and the UK, but mainly the British, we're obsessed with the Second World War, absolutely obsessed by it. So there's a company called DC Thompson who published things like Dandy and the Beano, well, not the Dandy anymore, the Dandy's gone, but the Beano, which is the oldest running comic in the world. And they bring out a comic, and they still do, called Commando. Now, Commando is a small digest book, so you're looking at something which is about A5 in size. And they bring these out. They bring out four a month. Now, I think two of them are at least going to be reprints, and then two are brand new. And these are little war stories. And as they've gone on now, they try and make them more modern. But for a long time, they were just basically about the Second World War, or you'd get the occasional Vietnam War stuck in or whatever. And they've been, I mean, you're now looking at a comic which is now numbered in the thousands. So you get one, it'd be like, you know, 1,900 or whatever.
Wow.
But they also did these fantastic books. And this comic range is called Star Blazer. Now, Star Blazer was a science fiction version, little self-contained one-off stories in this digest form, written by people like Grant Morrison starting out. So he wrote a couple of them, you know. And you'll find artwork from, like, you know, artists. But no one ever got credited, so you don't know who drew or who wrote what. But you get to recognize the style of drawing. So you will come across artists who sort of, you know, you've got things like Cam Kennedy. You'll find some of his are in there, you know. And so there's all these great names. Now, those are wonderful because they're really cheesy science fiction. I mean, dreadfully cheesy, like 1950s type science fiction. So there'll be, you know... Brad Zacharon, who'd be like this superhero sort of space agent for the stars. He'd have an incredible spaceship and a psychic robot, and they'd arrive on a planet which is being controlled by an evil computer, and they would cause an uprising that would see the computer destroyed, and they'd win, and they'd fly off into the sunset, you know? Brilliant stuff. And obviously, because they're like boys' own adventure, there's no dreadful girlies going on, and there's no sex in it at all. It's all action, and it's all macho stuff. Wonderful. So... Now, I sadly had every single one, and when I moved house 15 years ago, I made the decision back then to get rid of them, just got rid of them, which is a great shame because I'm now spending a fortune replacing them all. But I think that comes back to being a collector. There is that sense of I don't mind doing it a second time round, you know, and it's more fun. I'm sort of doing it gently and slowly, that sort of stuff, you know. So those are the sort of things, you know, but I think the thing about comics is that I keep being surprised by comics, because comics have changed so much since we've been reading them. And now we've got this whole thing where, like, major book publishers are doing graphic novels, and they're doing stuff that we never had growing up, you know. So you'll get people like, there's a brilliant cartoonist who wrote a guy, here he is, I've got it here in front of me, Guy, He wrote a book called Pyongyang, which is a journey in North Korea. He's an animator. He wrote a travelogue about his time in North Korea, working for an animation studio. Guy Delisle, I think it is, D-E-L-I-S-L-E. And that is absolutely wonderful. I just adored it. It just captivated me and took me there. So I find these sort of things. I think that's the interesting thing about comics is if you end up loving comics, it's like there's no one style of drawing. Everyone's got their own unique style. Everyone's got their own unique stories to tell. And that's what I find really exhilarating about comics is that there is so many ways to tell a story. Not just superheroes or whatever or horror or science fiction, but there's other stuff out there. And I find that really intoxicating.
So in addition to your passion for vintage titles, what current running titles are you intrigued by now? Which ones are you following, or do you just not have the time yet?
the most modern comic, and I'm actually currently reading my way through them. I'm up to volume 7, is I'm now currently rereading Invincible, which I absolutely adored. I thought Invincible was a terrific comic. And I'm reading that from the beginning. And when I finish that, I'm going to... This is my idea of modern comics, okay? Once I finish rereading that, I'm going to start rereading all of Why the Last Man, because I've not read it for ages. So that's what I do. That's my idea of reading new comics. That's the thing. You're right. It is very hard to find... I mean, that's the crazy thing. I said earlier on that I truly love making comics. And I do, because there's something exhilarating about them. It's fantastic. It's intoxicating. But I don't have time to read them in the same way. So when I look at a comic, it's much harder to read something now than it used to be, because I no longer read in the same way when I look at a comic. It's just a strange way of reading it. It's not done purely for pleasure anymore. It's a job. It's the way you read it. You don't get as much pleasure from it. So when I'm at work, I'll look at artists and be able to decide whether I like an artist instantly just based on one page of artwork. I can guess what they're like just from that one page, you know. It's weird. So I find myself, the older I get, I find myself returning to stuff that I know I love. And like I said earlier on, you know, I don't mind going back to old stuff, because you get that same buzz, that same thrill out of reading it again. So I'm always on the lookout for new stuff to read. But I do have to admit this, and this is probably a terrible thing to admit, and I'll probably get shot for this, is that when I said earlier on that I came to reading American superhero comics very late in life. And it's true. The first comic I read on a regular basis was Master of Kung Fu, okay? And I came to that quite late, you know? And I started reading it when Gene Day was drawing it. And I loved it. I thought it was wonderful. But then I also started reading... So my first introductions to American comics were... I knew about Batman and Superman, don't get me wrong. I knew about them because we saw those in reprints, and I used to buy them Marvel UK weekly, you know, that sort of stuff. But those comics were sort of reprints of the old Jack Kirby and the Steve Ditko stuff. So it wasn't new stuff, it was old stuff, but I was reading it for the first time. But the comics that I read that were new were things like Master Kung Fu, and there were things like Frank Miller's Daredevil. I didn't know who any of these guys were. And then also, I used to love reading Legion Superheroes. I don't know why, but it just used to really tickle me. So those are the comics that got me interested in reading American comics. And I think certainly people like, you know, Frank Miller, Daredevil, when he was first started, that was exhilarating.
Yeah.
So, and the crazy thing for me was I was at art college at the time, and then I got my first job when I left art college, and I was working as a ghost artist for an animator. I was drawing comic strips for him. And his studio was directly opposite a comic shop in London. And back then, I used to get paid cash in hand. I used to get the staggering sum of 80 quid cash in hand. So I gave my mum 5 quid a week for my rent and board, and I spent 5 quid a week on my travel card. The rest of the money I could spend on sandwiches and comics. And it was amazing, because I never had so much disposable income. You're talking about 70 quid a week, every week, just on comics. It was fantastic. I loved it. So I just found all these comics, and it was just heaven. It was just heaven on a plate. And I don't know why I've just told you that. If there was something I was going to tell you. It was the secret of the universe. I was about to reveal the secret, and now I've forgotten what it was.
Oh, no.
That's so annoying when that happens.
Well, the fact that you're an old fan of Master of Kung Fu, that's just awesome.
Oh, really? I tell you what was brilliant, right? I was fantastic. I got Paul Glacy to draw me a cover for Captain Kronos. That was sensational to actually write to Paul Glacy. Do you know, I've got to share this with you, because this is true. I think you might have guessed that I love comics. Okay? Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've mentioned it once or twice, maybe three or four times. But I effing love comics. I just love them. But I also love talking to creators. I mean, like, God, I got to work with Tom Mandrake on Captain Kronos. That was fantastic. Tom Mandrake, he's a brilliant artist. And that was just sensational. But when I write to these guys and I get emails back from them, I'm like, well, I've got an email from Paul Glacey. He's talking to me. That's fantastic. I've actually got, don't tell anybody, and obviously you're not recording this, I've got Paul Glacey's email address. That's fantastic. I get to talk to these guys. I get to talk to Mike Royer, who worked with Jack Kirby. I get to talk to Jack Kirby and Joe Simon's families. I get to talk to their children. That's amazing. My goodness, I got an email this week from Jerry Cornelius himself. So Michael Moorcock writes to me, and his email is always from Jerry Cornelius. That's fantastic. I mean, as a comic fan, as a science fiction fan, these sort of things just make it's worth getting up in the morning, you know? I mean, where else could you get that? It's just sensational, you know? You get to, when you talk to these artists and you get to, you do it over email. I know I don't meet them in person. They're nice guys and they're fascinating and they've got stories to tell. And it's just, it's brilliant because they're all artists, they're all creators. And I think I've never met a creative person who is boring. I've never met a creative person who wasn't interesting and worth talking to. Honestly, I'm blessed. I think I'm blessed to actually have a job like this because I can't think of anything else I would rather be doing than to be making and creating comics. It's just heaven on a plate.
Titan is also doing a reprint of Moorcock's Chronicles of Quorum, right?
Yes, not only Chronicles of Quorum, which I'm editing, by the way, but also, and this is fantastic. But we're also doing a collection of James Cawthorne's Rune stuff, the Chronicles of Hawkmoon. Chronicles of Hawkmoon, yes. Yes, I know. But we're doing, this is what's amazing. I've just finished putting together the first two stories. So the Amulet and the Skull and the follow-up. We've also just about to do the unpublished third part of the Hawkmoon series. So the bit that finishes it all off. 97 pages of artwork that's never been published before. Just unbelievably staggering. I've looked at it. It's just, honestly, there's an exceptional battle sequence in this book, the climactic fight, with these staggering double-page spreads. Just breathtaking. Absolutely breathtaking. And some of them are actually things like, we've actually got two gatefold pages in there, just of this artwork. Just extraordinary. Just amazing.
Well, this is so funny. Yeah. A friend of mine had never heard of Michael Moorcock. So right. I introduced him to Michael Moorcock with volume one of the Chronicles of Quorum. He's now really, really hooked.
I can see why. I mean, he's so prolific. I mean, just amazing, the amount of stuff that he's produced. Yeah. So we're doing Quorum, we're doing Hawkmoon, we're doing all of the Michael Moorcock books. They're just, that's great fun.
Oh, nice, nice.
You keep reminding me of all the things I'm working on.
Oh, well, hey, I think they announced that they're actually doing a movie for Why the Last Man. Did you see that?
Oh, I did, yeah. They're filming it now in New York. I thought it was going to be a series. Isn't it a TV series?
I'm not sure. I just remember seeing the announcement because like 5 billion things a second came out of Comic-Con, and I think that was one of them.
Isn't that weird when that happens? That's weird, yes. I would sit down and go through all the trailers. So I watched trailers for Shazam, Aquaman, and then Godzilla. I'm just crossing myself with a cross as I say Godzilla.
Oh my goodness, the Godzilla one made me cry. That brought a tear of joy to my when they announced the somebody had some like information from the panel about this, and they talked about the scale of the monsters, and then when you see Rodan exploding out of the volcano, I just cried. A little tear of joy came down my face. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I love Godzilla. I love Godzilla.
Those old movies.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Godzilla 1980 is one of my favorite films. I love that one. Just fantastic.
I can't wait to I can't wait to see Godzilla. The new Godzilla movie. I'm looking so forward to that. And Aquaman looked like it was going to be silly, like on a Thor kind of Thor Ragnarok level. So that I'm looking forward to that.
I don't know what my feelings are about that. I mean, I feel like I've been stung too much by the DC movies. I don't have any love for them. Whereas the Marvel ones, I'm constantly surprised at how they keep batting it out of the ballpark, to steal an American phrase. you know, I'm constantly surprised at how they keep doing it, and they keep sort of, you know, delighting me in and surprising me in equal measure. I think it's amazing. So it'd be nice if DC could find their own voice. So maybe Aquaman would do it.
Yeah, I'm hoping they score better with Aquaman. Now, me and like 8 other people liked Suicide Squad, so what do I know?
this conversation is coming to an end now. We can no longer talk.
Oh, no. But no, I just... Deadshot was just so enjoyable in that movie for me.
But then that's him. I mean, he's a brilliant actor. I mean, he has charisma oozing from every pore. It's impossible for him not to be likable in any film he makes. So that is quite helpful. I mean, do you know, his name has jumped out of my head. I know exactly who we're talking about.
Will Smith.
Thank you, Will Smith. Him and the girl that played Harley Quinn.
Margot Robbie.
Those two made that film. If it wasn't for them, that film would just be an absolute stinker.
I will give you that. The rest of that movie was disappointing because Amanda Waller should have been more present in that movie and more mean.
Well, I would have been happier if she hadn't explained the entire idea behind the Suicide Squad 3 times to 3 different groups of people in the first 10 minutes. That would have made me happier. But I don't want to come across as someone who's a ranter. So I'm going to stop complaining about Suicide Squad. But I do want Aquaman to be because I think he's brilliant. I think he's another actor with immense charisma, and he's gigantic. I saw him at a convention last year. He fills doorways. I mean, literally fills doorways. It's astonishing. I've never seen a human being that powerful, that huge. It was just remarkable, absolutely remarkable. I was actually too stunned to talk to him. I wanted to go up to him and say, hey, I really like your work, but I couldn't bring myself to do it.
That's okay. We always get shell-shocked when there's that, you know, that sort of imposing persona just standing there acting all cool. It was like, yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I already had to explain my embarrassment at meeting Will Eisner. So,
you know. Cool.
So, yeah, these things happen to me constantly.
Well,
very embarrassing.
Well, in that case, I will let you take off. David Leitch, thank you so much for your time today and for, you know, our mutual geeking out over comics was just delightful. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I feel we've only just scratched the surface. I'm sure we could discover that there's loads of things that we could spend hours talking about.
And we can continue that conversation when something else cool from Titan comes out that you're editing.
Okay. All right. I'll keep you posted what I'm doing next.
All right. David Leitch, editor at Titan Comics, working on some very, very cool titles coming out from them. You can find more at www.titanbooks.com. Are you on social media where people can, like, pick your brain now and then?
Well, I might have a presence on Facebook. I have my own cartoon character which I write and draw called Psycho Gran. She's got her own Facebook page and she's very chatty. And if you want to see pictures of a little old lady beating the living crap out of superheroes,
nice.
It's a great place to visit.
Well, we will include a link to that for our listeners. And
well, maybe next time we talk, I can talk all about the new books I'm doing. There are things like Diablo and Blade Runner. Maybe we can talk about those next.
I think we need to talk about Blade Runner. I really do.
Definitely.
So we can make an appointment to talk about that later. So
cool.
But for now, we will call it a day, and we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this. I love conversations that go off the intended rails, keep going and driving around town the long way around, where you take the highway, the loop, the highway loop that goes around the metropolitan area that takes you anywhere from 1 to 2 hours to get from, you know, from end to where you started again. Yeah, that sort of conversation just that brings joy to my heart, and hopefully you listening to it also brings you a little bit of joy. But since we are way past our usual time, we're going to call it for this episode, catch up a little bit more on the news of the week next week. Maybe. I don't know if I'll have a show next week because I will be at Scares That Care in Williamsburg, Virginia next week. So I don't know if I'll be able to have time to put out a show next Saturday, but we'll see what happens. In any event, if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976, or you can send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play. Yes, we're on Google Play now, on TuneIn and on Krypton Radio. And if you're listening on either iTunes or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let other people know that you are enjoying this show and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter, Slice of Sci-Fi. You can follow us on YouTube or Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi over there. And of course, we have the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on over, join in the reviews, leave your own reviews of movies that our team has reviewed. Leave comments on some of the commentary or chat with us on Twitter. That's probably the easiest, most direct way to get my attention these days. Not the only way, but probably the fastest. Thank you everyone who is helping support these websites and these podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Everyone who is currently supporting through Patreon pledges, thank you. If you want to add your support through Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/sliceofscifi and sign up over there. Also want to send a shout out to Sci-Fried, my favorite geek rock band, for providing the music for this show, this particular podcast. I am a rock and roll girl. I've always been a rock and roll fan, and these guys combine rock and roll and geekery masterfully. If you want to check out more music by them, their website is sci-fried.com. But that will do it for this episode. Thank you all so much for listening. And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi, maybe next week, but if not, definitely the week after that. Take care.